Hello and welcome to the Wednesday edition of the Daily Friend, your best source for news and analysis about South Africa and the world at large. I'm Nicholas Larimer. I'm filling in for Sihle Ngubesi, who is unfortunately not able to be with us here today. I'm joined by Editor-in-Chief of the Daily Friend, Sarah Gon. Sarah, how are you today?
Well, Nick, thank you.
Excellent. And Marius Ruert, the Head of Campaigns. Marius, how are you?
How's it, Nick? How's it going?
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about that beleaguered, suffering party, the DA, who last week...
Which one?
Who last week suffered a little bit of a setback. Marius, why don't you tell us about what exactly
another
happened?
Setback.
Yeah, so last week there were ten by-elections held last week. Five were DA, DA was defending five, the ANC was defending five. The ANC defended their five all fairly easily. Didn't really have threats from anybody. But while the DA, they got some big problems. So they lost the ward in Potch to the Freedom Front Plus. They lost another ward to the ANC in the Cedarburg. And the other three wards they defended, they lost about 20 percentage points in terms of support in two of those wards. The only one where they didn't really see a shrinking in support was in East London, where their support went down by only about 2 percentage points. The other two wards where they lost about 20-odd percent was in Kuruman and Saldanha. So... the DA has got big problems. They're losing support to on their right flank. So in a place like Potch, it's probably White Afrikaners who are banning them for the Freedom Front. So, yeah. And then in the Western Cape, a place like Saldanha, or in Cedarburg at least, Saldanha, that it's probably working class coloured people. So and these people are probably leaving the DA for the ANC. So the DA is losing support all over the place. And I think that's what happens when a party doesn't know what it is. Nobody in the DA could actually tell you what it stands for anymore, I don't think.
I mean, this seems like a total crisis. Sarah, what do you think this means for the leadership?
I think the leadership had better change, as should its principles. What's interesting, I remember reading something about the loss in Cape Town, some of the losses in Cape Town in the national election, and it seemed that there was a great amount of unhappiness amongst coloured voters, the feeling that yet again, a party wasn't representing their interests. And many of them supported Patricia de Lille, not because they cared about Patricia de Lille one way or the other, but because she was a coloured politician and they just felt underrepresented. And I think everyone's now feeling underrepresented by the DA. And it's every time there's a by-election, this is what the results largely look like.
Our former colleague, Gareth van Onselen, he pointed out on Twitter that since the national election in May, the DA has defended 30 wards in by-elections and lost 10 of them.
Sure.
They've lost a third of the wards they've, or nine of them. But anyway, it's about 30-odd percent that they've failed in defending, which is shocking. I mean, that is really bad for the DA, and they've got big problems ahead of them.
Yeah, and of course they're losing to parties that, you know, were kind of unimaginable. If you change good in the ANC for the ANC and the ID, this looks like the DA years ago, except they were taking these wards off of those parties rather than losing them. And the Freedom Front didn't used to exist. They seem to be winning seats that the National Party last won back in the sort of 2000s.
Apparently now in the Northwest, I mean, the DA is losing places it's held since 1998 when the DP first came and with Tony Leon started taking votes away from the NP. Now they're losing, they're bleeding those votes back to the, if you want to call it right wing loosely.
I think what the DA completely misunderstood and was very arrogant in during in the general election, and it's flowed over, is that it essentially disregarded the conservative right support, white support.
I don't think it's even conservative.
A lot of the rural areas would be considered sort of conservative, but these are supporters who've supported the DA for years, if not decades, and
20 years.
Yeah, at least. And they just really miscalculated. I think people felt they were not represented. They felt insecure. They felt they were dealing with a party that didn't necessarily have their back anymore. And after years of supporting them, they looked to previously unthinkable alternatives.
Well, we'll see what comes of this. The DA's elective conference is probably going to come up in the next couple of months, next year. And then we're going to see whether a challenger emerges to contest with Maimane, who is looking increasingly shaky as the leader.
But as we were talking before this, I mean, is there actually even a challenger to Maimane? Well, the DA that actually seems to be much better position than somewhere like the EFF, where that party is so dominated by Malema. There's no, I mean, people talk about Porfu and stuff, but we all know Malema is the EFF and EFF is Malema. But the DA does have quite a lot of personalities that in theory you think could take over the leadership, but would any of them want to do that?
Just because there aren't that many good candidates who are willing to stand doesn't mean that there won't be candidates who will stand and maybe even win.
Yeah.
There are, all of the provincial leaders probably have at least some ambition, and so I wouldn't put it entirely past them.
Can I perhaps ask a question in this way? What would any new aspirant leader have to do to recover the fortunes of the DA?
I think it's very difficult. They're going to have to clearly define the party's brand again as something, not the sort of amorphous, weak mass, that morass that it seems to
have. So wannabe ANC sort of thing that they seem to be.
Yeah, I mean, as liberals, we think obviously that the way to go forward is to go back to its liberal roots and come forward with a sort of bold message that's a real alternative to the ANC. One could make an argument, though, that simply being stronger on a few issues might actually be managed to rescue the party electorally. It's lost its anti-corruption. It used to be the forward party of anti-corruption, and it's sort of lost that to the EFF somehow.
Like loot VBS in your anti-corruption party.
But now's the time to get back for exactly that reason.
It needs to have probably more decisive leadership, because right now there's lots of factional battles within inside the party that are not properly resolved, because the leadership doesn't seem to be able to deal with them.
So Nick, if you had a magic wand and you could appoint somebody to be the leader of the DA, who would it be? And you're not allowed to say any former leaders.
No. I don't think it's a good idea to put former leaders back in power of old parties. It's never a good idea. But I would say I'm not actually sure, because you never really know what it takes to be the leader until you get one. You'd need someone who is very much a kind of a street fighter type of person, someone who is very determined and focused, but someone who's also a very good strategist. Mm. And there aren't, unfortunately, that many candidates out there like that at the moment.
I mean, as I was saying earlier, for me, somebody like John Steenhuisen would maybe be a good candidate, but also we don't know how woke the DA has got now. Would they even countenance having a white candidate?
Well, they would probably, as part of saving the party, they'd probably have to purge a lot of the sort of woke characters from the party who have dragged the party into kind of American cultural battles and kind of treat the party as though it's the Democratic Party of the United States, which is such a bad fit and doesn't speak to South African voters at all.
Mm. And I think in a way, for purely symbolic reasons, putting in a white leader again might reverse fortunes to an extent, because the impression I have from the DA's history since democracy is that the colour of the leader has never been an issue. Neither has the gender. If they are strong and firm and committed to liberal principles, people will respond to them.
Well, Gareth Van Onsen, I mean, he showed us some polling from a little while ago where Musima Amani was generally more unpopular than Tony Leon and Helen Zille had been when they were leader of, and that's with people who aren't necessarily DA or DP voters. Mm. Tony Leon and Helen Zille were both more popular than Musima Amani. Mm. This is amongst black voters. So just shows you, I think the only people who are really obsessed with race in South Africa is politicians. Most people are, I mean, of course, race is always going to be colour most things in South Africa because of our history, but I think the people who are most obsessed with it is politicians.
Anyway, that's very interesting. We'll have to see how that develops. So we've had now a threatened strike in the banking sector. And today, Business Unity SA is going to court to try and prevent the strike. The strike is about layoffs in the banking sector. Sara, why don't you tell us a little bit about this?
Okay. There are threatened retrenchments all over the sector, because partly because of the economic situation, partly because the nature of banking has changed. It's become more automated, more technologically, fourth industrial revolution, app banking, ADMs are the least of it, internet banking, that sort of thing. So there's generally less need for people. So this is a sort of fairly, shall I say, standard process that happens when businesses have to change to remain successful or to remain profitable or become more profitable. So putting out retrenchments is what happens, and what unions do is they negotiate against the retrenchments, and if they reach an impasse, hopefully all the legal process has been followed, they are allowed to strike over the issue. I can understand the banking companies themselves trying to interdict the strike if it's not been technically correctly followed. I don't understand where BUSA has the legal right to do so. It is it's an organization that is representative as a lobbying group of big business, and it is there to enhance the fortunes of its members. And it certainly may enhance the fortunes of its members by interdicting the strike, but I don't see where they have. So I can't, sorry, I've suddenly forgotten the right phrase, but they don't have the legal standing to do so. So I'm not quite sure why BUSA is getting involved.
What was the reason they gave for why they're opposing the strike? What
was it something like the South African economy can't afford it?
It's a bit broad.
Well, so it's a bit broader than a whole lot of other things.
Government, I'm afraid.
I would have thought they'd better, if they had the legal standing, they would be better off saying South Africa can't afford to have SAA running any further. But I don't understand. I don't know where they. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they do have, but I can't see it.
Okay. Maurice, considering that finance has been actually probably one of the healthiest sectors in the economy, seeing labor unrest there is a little bit of a worrying sign. What do you think?
I think it is, and it's obviously to do with, it's a terrible phrase, but I mean, the fourth industrial revolution where things are, you know, actually if somebody says that, they don't know what they're talking about, so. But I do think that's I mean, things are changing.
It's funny that you say that, because of course the strikers say that one of their demands is that we need, the banking sector needs to come up with a answer for the fourth industrial revolution.
But they are doing that. They've come up with the absence of. But I just have to say, as somebody who works for an NGO and has a BA, I'm not really that worried about the strike, because I don't have any money in the bank anyway. So,
what little money I do have, however, I have to admit I have used cell app banking and online banking for over 10 years. And I mean, I'm not in the first flush of youth. I have probably gone near a teller 5 times in 15 years. So there is definitely that, and that's a purely change in business. That's not that per se has nothing to do with the economy. That's a change in the way business is structured, and businesses have to adapt. Exactly. The very sad result is it can often lead to retrenchments, but that's.
But people always
the world's allowed to work that way.
But there's always these this hysteria when technology changes and so on, and it was like there's going to be this like massive underclass of 90% of people unemployed, and there's always some disruption. But I mean, this is, I don't know, who knows when that is, it the fourth one, but whatever. But then we've had a couple of industrial revolutions, and we had the Luddites who literally were destroying technology because they're worried about their jobs. And but now we saw how people adapt, the economy adapts. These people, I mean, it's obviously terrible for people to lose their jobs, but things will adapt, and we aren't going to have this massive 90% unemployment. I mean, if the ANC stays in charge of that, but if things, I mean, if we become a country that runs things properly, we will not have, I mean, people will adapt and companies will adapt.
Well, essentially, that's how capitalist, democratic capitalist societies work. Is those constant changes.
Those creative distraction is the term.
Yeah, and that's how it works, and that's why those societies have continued to exist compared to their socialist counterparts.
There is an argument that's made by many people across the sort of thinking, scientific-y community, I guess, or people who like to style themselves that way. Everyone from American presidential candidate Andrew Yang to famous YouTuber CPG Grey, they've talked about that, no, this industrial revolution is different because it won't be technology replacing manual work. It'll be robots replacing human beings because the robots will be as good as human beings. I've always been a bit skeptical of this because part of this argument is that we'll begin to see unemployment of low-skilled people. South Africa notwithstanding, unemployment is very low across the entire planet at the moment.
I think that it's in the developed world, or maybe even the whole world, I read a stat in The Economist, it's the lowest it's been since the 80s or something, global unemployment. So
yeah, so it suggests that if there is some great tidal wave of technological innovation to wipe out, it's not here yet, at the very least, and maybe it's not coming. I do think it's a little bit of a fool's game sometimes to try and predict what the effect of technology is.
And particularly when people try to predict what the effect of robots would be. I mean, I don't mean to assume that robots just cannot be the same as human beings, but ultimately human beings have the control.
Have you not seen the Terminator or the Matrix?
I'm not a sci-fi type fan. I know you're. But that's the point, is that to a large extent with technical change, you don't entirely know what's going to happen. Mm. And that applied to the first industrial revolution, the second industrial revolution. I've now forgot which was the third and the second. But, you know, being safe is not what keeps societies alive.
Yeah, no, when the first industrial revolution happened, everyone was traveling around in sailing ships and we had monarchs.
Mm.
And now we live in a sort of global interconnected world where everything is moved around on giant shipping containers and we have unimaginable levels of prosperity.
It takes you 12 hours to get from here to London, for example.
Yeah, it's a world completely unchanged. So I think trying to predict the precise things ahead of time is probably a bit of a fool's
game. And there's also another thing. There are industries that will need to rely heavily on unskilled or semi-skilled labor. Areas of tourism, areas of agriculture, there's certain areas you just cannot mechanize. And this is what we need our government to be freeing the economy up for, and not that I've seen lately.
What's probably going to happen with the development of this kind of technology is there will be some sort of breakthrough revolution that will come from a direction no one expected. Mm. Mm. In the way that cell phones changed a whole lot of society and no one saw that coming.
Mm.
All right, so that's very interesting, something to look forward to, or fear, depending on your position. So just to finish off today, Sara, you read an article recently about the death of decency in the British media, but I think we can expand this to sort of the global media as a whole.
Okay.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about what that article was about? Okay.
It was an article by Simon Lincoln Reader, who now writes for Business News. He's a South African based in London. I think he's in the investment community. And it was deeply sad and chilling at the same time. And he noted what he called the death of common decency that once characterized the respected British media, notwithstanding their political leanings. So whether right, left, centre, was never an issue. With the development of the progressive left across the world and in the media, a leftist paper that one would have put in that category of respected, The Guardian, and which is still regarded as Britain's foremost left-wing newspaper, in Lincoln Reader's assessment, stooped to a new low in an editorial last week commenting on former Prime Minister David Cameron's memoirs, which were released last week. The editorial stated that because of who he was, the pain of the death of his severely disabled son Ivan in 2009 was diminished. I mean, if that isn't an inhuman response, that because he was the Conservative Prime Minister, the death of his son, who had been disabled for 6 years, you know, he was 6 years old and he died when he was six.
He was born disabled, right?
He was born disabled with a severe neurological disorder, I gather, which manifested as a severe form of cerebral palsy, which came with bouts of epilepsy. He was quadriplegic, being unable to crawl, walk, or talk properly. And as Lincoln Reader further noted, this was not the work of a single journalist or commentator, but the view of the newspaper compiled by at least three, maybe even four or five senior personnel. There was no explanation or apology from the editor-in-chief, Catherine Viner, on her Twitter account or anywhere else, although apparently she spoke a great deal about Greta Thunberg. And just the use of language by the aggressive left to marginalize and discredit has become beyond insulting. I mean, it has absolutely no empathy.
I think looking through the long annals of human history, one will find that the dehumanization of people usually is the preceding event to something very unpleasant. It can be many different things. It can be war. It can be genocide. It can just be disenfranchisement. Marius, what do you think about this?
I think it's a problem in politics in general. If somebody disagrees with you, then you can treat them as less than a human being. Because whatever you think about David Cameron and his politics, to have that happen to you and to go through that with a child is terrible. We should not say, we don't know how David Cameron felt. Maybe he didn't feel the same as other people. Maybe he was completely devastated. Just because he was upper-class British person who's, you know, probably hasn't too difficult in his life. This was probably one of the hardest things he ever had to go through. And I'm sure nobody else, you would not wish what he had to go through on anyone. And it's actually disgusting, The Guardian, to say, to diminish David Cameron and his wife's suffering through this thing. You know, no matter what you think about Cameron and Brexit and his politics, he's still a human being. And was, I mean, if this happened to Julius Malema, I would feel terrible for Julius Malema. I would not say this is, you know, whatever, you know, poor man, something terrible has happened.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, usually it's this sort of personal tragedy that we understand to would unite people. I mean, people would respond, irrespective of where they come from, they would respond appropriately. And let's be honest, David Cameron wasn't exactly Margaret Thatcher. I mean, if you want sort of creatures of hated by the left. But in any event, I mean, he certainly wasn't Hitler or Pol Pot or anybody in that extreme, in those extreme circumstances.
But because he's a member of the Tory Party, and suddenly
he's paying his something.
Exactly,
less.
That's the worst thing you could have done. Jeez, look.
No, it's a very nasty sort of. It feels like a new take on old British classism, where sort of every class hates each other.
Yeah.
But it's this global movement of kind of social justice hierarchy seems to be returning us to the older, more hierarchical structures of the past.
I think one of the just one of the ironies, though, probably most of the people who work for the Guardian wrote this article. Probably went to private schools,
absolutely,
and maybe not Eton, but probably private schools come from solid middle class families in the UK. Mm. But I mean, they're probably the same kind of class as David Cameron. But now they've, you know, voiced their, you know, they've decided that they, you know, the vanguard of the working class, and they're probably not anything close to.
Well, it's like the people who went to, I don't know, Cares or something, writing about how terrible people from St. John's are.
Yeah, exactly.
I think the problem is that the Guardian has got to be the most elite institution in and of itself, and I don't imagine the Sun, which is generally regarded as a sort of right-wing populist rag, which probably is a right-wing populist rag, I don't believe they would have expressed the same.
Yeah, if it happened to Jeremy Corbyn's kid or something, I'm sure they wouldn't have. I don't think Corbyn has kids, but I mean, for an example.
So, let's not go there.
No, I do think he's.
Maybe he does, but we just don't know about it.
All right, so I think that's all the time that we have for today. Thank you very much, guys, for some insightful, interesting conversations. If you like what we do here, please support us by SMSing your name to 32823. Terms and conditions apply, and SMSs cost 1 rand. We'll catch you on the next episode of The Daily Friend.